If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblogues.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
Hi. AI agents are everywhere in the headlines, but building them for production is a different story. Welcome to Inside Assemble AI, where we explore how AI is transforming the way we build software. I'm Sam Day, joined with my podcast co-host Mac. And today we are diving deep into the world of AI agents, how they are built, how they work in production, and where this technology is headed. Our guest has been at the forefront of developing tools for over a decade, and now he's building the framework that's helping developers create production-ready AI agents.
And I'm Mac Goswami. Today we have a special guest, Sam Bhagwat, joining us. Sam is a co-founder and CEO of Mastra, a TypeScript framework for building AI agents and agentic applications. Before Mastra, Sam was the co-founder of Gatsby, where he helped build one of the most popular React-based web frameworks, scaling it to hundreds of thousands of developers worldwide. During Y Combinator in late 2024, Sam made waves not just with code, but by authorizing and distributing over 70,000 physical copies of Principles of Building AI Agents, bringing developer education into the physical world. Sam is passionate about making AI accessible to every developer and believes that AI will enable everyone to become a developer. Sam, welcome to Inside Assemble AI podcast.
It's so great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
It's our privilege to have you with us, Sam. So let's dive into the Q&A section. So we're going to start at the beginning of Mastra. You are building an AI CRM during a hackathon in October 2024, and something clicked. What was the moment when you realized you should pivot from building the CRM itself to creating the agentic framework for Mastra?
Thanks for that's a great lead up question. There were kind of two key insights that we had. The first thing was, you know, we'd been building developer tools, as you said, for 10 years. And so we actually moved out of developer tools. And then we were sort of looking for tools to build our kind of AI agentic CRM and in TypeScript. And we were very big TypeScript developers. My co-founders were two of the key engineers behind Gatsby, and then, you know, myself, I was the co-founder. So we were very frustrated with the existing state of the TypeScript tooling for AI, and we found ourselves kind of rolling a lot of this ourselves. And we had this kind of moment where we just looked at each other and we're like, well, we know how to do this. We know how to do this really, really well, even though we didn't go into this with like, hey, like, let's make another developer tool. We know what the next 5 to 10 years look like down this path. And like, let's, you know, we were just like, should we do this? And like, yeah, we ourselves understand the pain, and we ourselves know that we have really deep expertise in doing in open source developer tools. And so those were kind of the two things, like solving our own pain point in a way that we knew how to do.
That's a fascinating pivot point. And thanks for sharing your story, Sam. Now, here's something that caught my attention. So right in the middle of Y Combinator, when most founders are laser-focused on metrics and code and how they can grow their business organically, you decided to write a book. Not just any book, but Principles of Building AI Agent. And you distributed over 70,000 physical copies, and you made thousands of posts on LinkedIn, and that one of the posts actually caught my attention in the first hand. So I'm kind of curious to know why physical books and why not just blog posts or documentation that you decided to kind of share your knowledge and expertise about AI agents to the world.
Yeah. So, you know, Y Combinator sort of teaches you, you know, to talk to your users. And as some folks who are kind of, you know, doing open source for the last decade, that's also like very ingrained. So you have this like really strong relationship with your users. Early on in YC, what we were basically doing was we were bringing people over to our apartment / office and doing kind of whiteboarding sessions where we were kind of sharing. Someone would be like, hey, I'm building an AI agent for a medical records use case, right? It's like, I want to ingest a bunch of records and, you know, sort of like go through hey, does this person exhibit these symptoms? Make some sort of like preliminary guess on what might be the problem. As an example, that's like one thing we were doing a whiteboarding session with a user about. After we did about 20 or 30 of these whiteboarding sessions, my co-founder just kind of turns to me and Shane turns to me and he was sort of like, well, it seems like we're saying the same things over and over again, you know? And what we kind of realized was that we were in this, the middle of this world, and you know, we were in Y Combinator, about like half of the startups in our batch were building various sorts of agents. And we realized that like we had actually a little bit of insight into the general patterns behind this, and like that might be sort of like useful to share. And so we actually just thought it would be kind of a funny thing if we sort of showed up to, I'd written a book before, and my grandfather was a publisher in Mumbai. Like I'd done journalism when I was in school, so I'm a quite good technical writer. And so I was like, hey, like why don't we, you know, kind of write some of these, and how would we distribute this knowledge? And we thought like, well, our demo day is coming up. What if we just sort of showed up to demo day with books? Like that would be kind of an unusual thing to do. Right. And you know, it turned out that when we did that, a lot of people like responded positively. We got a lot of people who read the book and then were sort of recommending to other people in the batch, oh, like this thing that I learned here, what if you built your agent in this way that takes into account like best streaming practices for displaying user input that's coming from an agent, and sort of like incrementally showing things, not leaving the user waiting. They would learn a lot of things from our book that they would then teach other people. And so we, you know, starting from that moment, which was in March, right, we just started kind of going down this path of, you know, putting more and more time and effort into sort of the book. Both, you know, we wrote a new edition of the book in May, and then sort of like started distributing it at events where it sounded like you got a copy there, Sam. And, you know, then we sort of followed it up with a sequel, Patterns for Building AI Agents, in last month in November, right? So, but like it was ultimately, I think, about our users and sort of potential users almost like pulled the book out of us and in sense of like they just wanted, people wanted more and more of it. So we just spent more and more time and effort distributing books.
Thanks, Sam. It's good to know that you already have another book, and I'm excited to read that during my holiday break. And to my listeners, if you want to read Sam's book, I believe the Principles of Building AI Agents are currently available for purchase online on Amazon Bookstore and other online forums. So please check it out. And we'll also drop the links in the podcast description for your review. So having said that, I'm going to pass it over to Mac for the next question.
Thanks, Sam. So Sam, your journey from the Gatsby to Matthias is so fascinating. And, you know, like we are kind of, we three kind of sharing a similar kind of journey, not just from the startup, but I think I am mostly the development background. So I really love that the, you know, like your complete journey. Having said, I would come to the technical questions later on, but I just wanted to know how you manage the time that when you are writing the books, because I know that you are very busy, that when you were building Gatsby and then, you know, like the next company, Mastra. Then at the same time, when you were writing the books, how you were dedicating your time to writing the books, and how AI helped you to write your book?
Yeah, I mean, so one thing I'll say is I have like two really amazing co-founders, Shane and Abhi, and you know that sort of affords me that, like, you know, the weekend the couple weekends that it took me to write the first draft of the book, I could kind of lock myself inside the room and write. I think. You know, like, I don't really use AI in my writing process. It sounds kind of odd. I just write really quickly. I used to be a journalist when I was in college, and I would sort of get back from an event and, you know, just sort of like crank out 600 words in an hour and a half and kind of turn it into my editor before, you know, the print deadline. So I do think that, you know, I actually think that, like, somewhat in reverse, people are getting used to seeing like LLM assisted writing, and they're sort of seeing some of the smells of that. I think the thing about the book being both physical and kind of like, I try to have a personality when I write, and I, you know, I'll tell some jokes and stories in the book, and you can, you know, I just write about a little bit about, like,
if you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblokes.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
Myself and my journey in the intern, you can tell it's like just very human. And I think like that actually, and then, you know, having the physical book, I think that actually one of the things to be thinking about work products is like, how do you distinguish what you're doing in an age of AI? And, you know, one thing is like, some people ask themselves, and I think this is a valid way of doing it, you know, hey, how can I use AI to multiply my talents and my efforts? And I think another way of doing it is, how do I create work product that is so good that it stands out in a world where maybe other people are making AI assisted work products? And so that was kind of my take on you know, developer education in the age of AI. And I think, you know, this is a conversation that obviously we're like three human beings that are, they're passing jokes back and forth to each other, right? You know, I think people like listening to and you guys have an audience that's like gotten used to your voices and your interactions with each other and your stories and your backgrounds. And I think leaning into the human element of you know, connection in an age of AI is equally and maybe even the best way of doing it.
Great. Thank you, Sam. My next question is that you have been through this before with Gatsby, building for developers, scaling a community, creating educational content. How did those lessons from Gatsby inform the way you approached building Masper's development experience? What did you lean forward and what did you intentionally leave behind?
So the funny thing about running an open source community is that it's a very egalitarian place. You know, in our Discord, we never know if this like PvP avatar, right, is a director at some Fortune 500 company or a startup founder or, you know, some guy in Poland or in, you know, Spain or in India or, you know, wherever, right? Like you never know, or a 16-year-old in their parents' basement, right? Like it could be any of these people. And you just kind of, you learn to respond to people based on the quality of their questions. You learn to be helpful. You learn to, like, you learn how to maintain a sort of a community that people help each other. You learn to write really good documentation that sort of exhaustively covers all the areas that you need to cover. It has the right examples to help people get started. It has a really crisp onboarding experience. And you sort of, you can say all these things, but the amount of time that we just agonize over, should our API be called this or that? Which word is better? You know, should it be server context or runtime context? And, you know, we'll go back and forth about these things for way longer than anyone that hasn't been in our world would find reasonable to do. The amount we obsess over these details because your APIs are your... So I think that, like, there's a lot of, you know, I think there's also like a sense in which, you know, there's some people where for them, like marketing is like finding like the really sort of hotshot VP or director and presenting yourself in exactly the right way to that person. And for us, like marketing is, and is developer education. It's helping people understand how to solve a problem that they have with a tool that they can use to do it. It's again, like, it's like, we've watched sort of like, you know, it's amazing to see how many of the lessons from the first time come around. Like when we were building that sort of agentic CRM, it kind of felt like we were figuring out a lot of things, like, oh, should we do it this way or that way? You know, and we kind of debate it. But, you know, this time around, like, we know our intuition works so well. We have a really good sense for how to, okay, should the API be this or that way? And we just feel like we're moving really fast because we understand what to do.
Absolutely. Since you mentioned actually the API stuff, now I want to go more technical. Mastra has 6 core primitives: agents, workflows, tools, memory, evals, tracing. So can you please walk us through like why these 6 specifically? Like why not 5? Or, you know, why not 10, 3? What makes is the right level of abstraction for production of AI application?
Yeah, so fundamentally, there's 2 different ways of building an agentic application, right? You can sort of you can run an LLM in a loop, or you can kind of precisely define the execution graph. And so that's sort of the concept of an agent kind of versus a workflow. And then, you know, if you think about, like, there was actually a debate before we kind of came to the scene of like some people were sort of more pro agent and some people were more pro workflow. And we really just saw it as a trade-off of like power versus control. You know, sometimes your loop might go off the rails, but like it's easier to get started with and it can accomplish more. And so, you know, you can precisely define the execution graph, but if you when you feel like this is an area where I want to have really fine-grained control. So we actually added both primitives, and that was, a lot of folks have actually followed our example since then, but we were the first or one of the first to do that. And then if you think about sort of like downstream of that, you know, like an agent has a memory, which is sort of like a compression of the set of messages that it has that the user interacts with it, and like sort of a set of tools. And so you can see those as like sort of subcategories of like the agent primitive. But people, as they're moving their agent into production, this kind of idea of evals, which is really just kind of testing, but it's a quantitative type of testing, a statistical type of testing that's emerged. And then, you know, the sort of, you have the evals and then the traces, which are this kind of raw exhaust of the agent. And really, like, that is kind of like, we watch how people behave, and the teams that take agents from prototype to production use those tools, use evals, and they use traces. And so those are kind of emerged as like, okay, well, we want kind of like first class support for these. I will say that, you know, over time, you know, things are becoming and this isn't just the Mastra API, but this is sort of the state of the industry, right? You know, each of these areas is getting more complex. There are new types of memory that are emerging. There's more attention being paid to prompt management, for example, more attention being paid to sort of like model routing and fallbacks. And so, you know, I don't like the number of primitives is sort of out of a point of time, but, you know, like as we are spending more effort on developing these kind of sub primitives into their own kind of first class objects as well, as our users are asking that from us.
No, absolutely. I actually love that. And then I really love the foundations, that the way you build Mastra, the 6 different foundations. Love that. So for my next questions, I'm going to pass it over to Sam.
Thanks, Mac. The next question is kind of stemming from the book actually I read recently, and the book actually showed at the beginning of this episode. So one of the key differentiators I've noticed is Mastra's explicit control flow approach versus something like LangGraph's graph-based orchestration. So, I mean, just to take this more on a technical tangent, can you break down that fundamental difference between Mastra's approach versus LangGraph's or any other agentic framework's approach? And when should a developer reach for Mastra versus utilizing any other agentic framework?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest recommendation that we have, well, one of the biggest recommendations we have is you know, is it, you probably have a strong opinion about what language you want to build in. And that's going to be driven, by like, well, my whole team is full stack developers, so we're going to want to go in with TypeScript if we can, you know, versus, you know, maybe your team is more data engineers or data scientists and prefers to be in Python. So I think you should start with the language. And then when you start with the language, you should think about, well, what is a great sort of like tool in that language, right? And so we are a Python first, Python only framework, because again, we're kind of students of developer tools, and it's really unusual to have any sort of like framework kind of cross language layers, because things that feel natural in Python don't feel natural in TypeScript and kind of vice versa. And so we kind of feel that like the framework should be organic to the language and its libraries and its syntax. And so, you know, first off, I think if you're in Python, there's a lot of great Pythonic frameworks. But if you're in TypeScript, you should pick a TypeScript native, something that feels like native to TypeScript, right? And I would not include like LangGraph or LangChain on that list. They've sort of ported a lot of their APIs over. Some of them they haven't ported over. It doesn't feel like a TypeScript library. The type support isn't sort of like very good. But then I would also just kind of think about like you kind of want. So the thing, there's a few things that like folks really like about Mastra, and like the thing that like folks.
If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblokes.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
Tell us that they like the most is like the experience that they have of working locally in their like Mastra studio. So you can run npm run dev from the command line, and you basically get like an interface on top of all your agents, your workflows. It shows you your memory, and it gives you this sort of inner iteration. Like you can iterate really quickly with all of your primitives and then kind of like chat with your agents, see your traces, see your evals, because you can see the results really quickly and easily. You can sort of move more quickly. And ultimately, like, we encourage people to pick the tool that we think helps, that you feel like helps you move fast, like optimized for your own developer experience. And so, like, for someone, we think that we offer that best for TypeScript, but like ultimately, like, it's, you know, developer experience is in the eye of the beholder. If you should use a tool that you feel like is most natural for you.
Yeah. No, totally agree with that. Especially considering that TypeScript has kind of like become one of the most popular object-oriented scripting language nowadays, having a specific framework for that programming language would be definitely a developer's preference. And I think I would definitely recommend the all the listeners here, we're kind of like in the TypeScript and AI agentic framework space, to try out Mastra and see their agentic framework platform would probably benefit some of your development work for the TypeScript programming language. So thanks, Sam. Moving on to kind of on a related note, wanted to kind of like just pick your brain on some of the development experience that you had with a lot of developers, because you definitely built a lot of agents. Even before Mastra, I'm pretty sure you worked a lot of agentic stuff when it first came out in early 2024, that concept. From your experience, could you please share with our listeners that what are the biggest gaps you see when people try to move from prototype to production? What breaks? How does Mastra specifically address those pain points when it comes to building agentic framework from the ground up?
Yeah, so I mean, this is something we talk about. This is actually why we wrote our second book, you know, Patterns for Building AI Agents. Because like What we've seen is that, like, when you understand the principles, the building blocks, agents, workflows, you know, RAG, memory tool calling, evals, tracing, you can sort of go and prototype and build something that you're like, hey, it's an agent. But then, like, in order to kind of ship it into production in a user-facing capacity, you have to do a lot to sort of make sure the agent doesn't hallucinate, to make sure that the quality of the responses is good, that it's doing the right kind of tool calling, that's like correctness. You know, there's a few different of these, you know, metrics. And so this is kind of, there's a few different domains that, like, once you get to prototype that you start thinking about more. One is called like context engineering, which is this combination of sort of prompt engineering, memory, sort of like state management. And it's like kind of like, think about it from this perspective, right? Imagine that, you know, we hired somebody to do a job for us and they didn't do a very good job of a task that we gave them. So, you know, and then we're like, well, why did that happen? Right. So we would have to kind of like retrospect, like, well, was it that we didn't give them very clear instructions about what to do? Or was it that we did actually give them clear instructions for what to do? And they still like, you know, got the incorrect like answer or came back. Or maybe we gave them clear instructions, but we told them, you know, to do something, but we didn't give them permissions in the system that they needed. So maybe it was like a tooling issue, right? The instructions were good, but it was a tooling issue. So they weren't able to complete the task. So this is like what context engineering is about, is like understanding, like, did I give the agent all the right context that it needed to solve the problem? So, you know, and then kind of like eval, like, so I think that's like one bit of it. Then the second part is evals, and evals are a little bit controversial. I will say that, like, you know, there was a big debate on Twitter X about this a couple of months ago, and it actually depends a lot on industry. So like, it's kind of about folks who are in a highly regulated industry or who have like high cost of, you know, where the cost of being wrong is higher, like think medical or legal or like, right, these sort of industries, right? They tend to rely more on evals. Whereas if you're building something that's more of like a dev tool or a consumer app, especially like a, you know, or dev tool, for example, if you write incorrect code, you can evaluate that code. You can try to run that code and see if it, check if it gets like the right thing. So it's a little bit more easily checkable. So there's like this divide in evals between folks who are sort of like higher cost of failure versus lower cost of failure. But the what we recommend is that you should have metrics. You should have metrics for quality and have a sense of like how well your agent is performing against that. Whether that is evals, whether that's like real world A/B testing, you know. But you should have some metric for that, and you should try to optimize that metric over time.
Yeah. No. Totally. Totally, I mean, agree with you on the context engineering part. And, you know, that's kind of becoming one of the things that's transformed the feature engineering space. I think, you know, if I put my data science hat on, I think we are kind of focusing less on feature engineering than more moving on to the context engineering part. And I think that's the future we are heading, where large language models are going to do that context engineering part for ourselves.
Well, this so totally is a funny podcast to be on as well, because like your background from like the data science space, in many ways, engineering is this combination of data science and engineering, where you're building a production application, but yet you have to be able to take a statistical mindset and sort of like, you know, hey, I have this like somewhat arbitrary, somewhat stochastic process. And given that, how do I like reduce the variability here and make this kind of like quality graph go up over time, which is, you know, it's a little bit interdisciplinary, right? And I think that's why the skill set is so prized and so like somewhat rare still, although, you know, increasingly common over time, and having more folks like figure this out now is because you have to put these different areas of expertise together.
I think the statistical measure and benchmark testing will always be there. Doesn't matter how far we progress in the AI world, we still have to measure performance, and we need to use statistics for that. I mean, I'm glad that these discussions shaping up really well. And now I'm going to pass it over to Mac to take us to a few more technical round questions. Mac, over to you.
Sam, that you actually mentioned that about the context engineering stuff, and I really love that. So we are actually creating one big AI chatbot agent in my office. And since you actually mentioned the context stuff, so we were providing the right data sets, but still we're not having the right result. And, you know, like every time it was giving the wrong output, hallucinated. So then we sat with the data scientist, and then we came to that, like, we need to put enough context even before tryout, like all the prompts before. So I completely resonate with that, you know, like the context engineering is now is everything. And, you know, especially that when you were building bot and especially if you're creating the LLM. So let's talk about the Model Context Protocol, MCP. So Anthropic's been pushing this as a way to standardize tool sharing across different frameworks. Now, how do you see MCP changing the agent ecosystem? Does it make frameworks more interoperable or does it create new challenges for you?
Yeah, I mean, MCP has been one of the biggest innovations in 2025. I think you could, if you look at what's changed in 2025, a lot of sort of like what we consider agents and workflows, like they, you could kind of see the foreshadowing of like, hey, like they're starting to get to take off in 2024. And, you know, as the models get better, they will just kind of keep going up into the right. Whereas MCP was like a net new innovation. The way to think about this is that agents are only as powerful as the tools that you give them. And operating with third-party APIs is difficult, and they're like mostly built for humans. So if you looked at, like, for example, like the OpenAI workflow builder that they released at Dev Day a couple of months back, you could see that like whenever they were using calling a third-party system, whether that was like Shopify or Notion or Linear, they just used like the MCP server. And so what that sort of enabled them to do is kind of have this like pre-baked tool set and sort of solve the auth problem and kind of, or simplify, not solve, but certainly simplify the auth problem. And all of a sudden you could kind of give this agent a lot of the power that it didn't otherwise have. And I think that was like one of the most, I think that demo, I think clicked for most, just because it was so widespread, clicked for most folks of like how powerful the MCP protocol is. We've also seen, you know, I think it's especially also like if you look at sort of a company like Shopify that has a huge ecosystem, it's a great way of like, and a lot of the complexity of building apps in this ecosystem is munching a bunch of different APIs. I think that's why you've seen Toby be so excited about MCP is that it is kind of giving the ability to sort of define tools in such a way, not have this like N by N and like model to tool, you know, matching problem. But like you get like, instead of having to write, instead of like just being able to expose like tools in a friendly way for agents.
Sam, since you mentioned about the API stuff and also, you know, and you also brought up the Shopify stuff. I was an extensively user for the Shopify in my past. So just one question, it just came to my mind. If I use MCP and then, you know, like calling all the, you know, webhooks through the Shopify, have you ever seen any kind of performance issue? Like, so let's say if my aim is to, you know, to download a large number of data sets, right? Through the Shopify, it's all the catalog, all the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, you should. I think like the main thing that to think about when avoiding performance issue is just the round trip request time, right? So if you think about sort of the challenge with a remote MCP server, if you have to, let's say you want to paginate your data and you know, 50 pages of data, and then all of a sudden that's like 50 requests back and forth. I think like if you need this kind of like bulk versus like if you think about the experience that you have maybe when you're in Cursor and you're sort of or Cloud Code and you're like, hey, I need to like grab some, you know, I want to do this, and you watch the agent sort of, you know, grab some context from a file and it's like, oh, that was part of the right context, but I need to go to this other file and grab the context. That loop is like much faster. And so I think that, you know, like it's always a risk to try to do bulk tasks over APIs, over remote APIs, you know, and like that's always, whether you're doing that with an agent or whether you're like writing a script to like, you know, scrape a bunch of data or pull a bunch of data, you know, that's, so I think like you're right that like bulk data collection can pose problems. But I think those are mostly related to the scope of what you're trying to do rather than maybe MCP specific.
And now I want to shift to something that's been on my mind, but we are seeing small language models like, you know, Tencent 0.5 billion parameter model running offline on smartphones. When you can run capable models like entirely on device, how does that change your vision for Mastra and how agents get deployed. Are we heading toward a world where the framework matters less than the deployment target?
I think that what we see is that a framework with a model routing harness essentially lets you say I have 27 tasks that need to be done, and I can choose any model for any task as long as you're using an abstraction that lets you just easily swap out a model with just a string, right? This is called model routing. And as long as you have that abstraction that makes it easy, you can always be testing new models that come out. If you have an eval scaffold, you can evaluate them fairly quickly. So I do think that in general, the framework makes model swappability easier, right? Whether it's large models, small models. I've been pretty excited about small models for various types of tasks. For example, structured object generation, sometimes you can have it do a second pass at, JSON to make sure it's not malformed, this kind of thing. And a quick two-pass thing. I think there's interesting on-device applications. The curious thing to me is actually, if you look at some of the statistics, and OpenRouter just did a study on this, if you look at their state of AI, but it's actually over the last year, as their volume has text of the number of tokens being generated on OpenRouter, the balance has actually shifted. I think if I remember the numbers correctly, it used to be maybe 30 to 40% small language models, and now it's down to about 20 or 30%. If I had to hazard a guess as to why that's happening, software tends to go through a three-step process. And the first step is make it work. The second step is make it right. And the third step is make it fast, cheap, et cetera. It's we've got the technology figured out. We just need to run it at scale efficiently or whatever. And I think that the reason that we're seeing sort of small language models actually go down over time as agentic applications gain more mainstream traction is because the structure right now we're in this we're still in the make it work phase, and I think maybe in a year or two, as we're more people start entering the optimization phase, they'll can we swap out a small language model for a 5.1 or for Claude 4.5 or essentially but we're still, so many people are on this make it work phase that we haven't yet gotten to that part of the puzzle.
Great answer. Thanks, Sam. I think we are almost to the last for our entire podcast. And for the last segment, I'm going to pass it over to Sam.
Thanks, Mac. Now, it's a final question before we move on to the closing statement. So, Sam, let's say it's 2030, 5 years from now. What does the agentic application landscape look like? Especially if you think about that thesis that you have where every developer should be able to build with AI and AI allows everybody to be a developer. Do you think that things will coincide with the agentic landscape in 5 years from now? And also, what do you think Mastra fit in that futuristic landscape?
Absolutely. I mean, we just got, right before our call, we were over at the Replit office where we were meeting with the Replit sort of agent team. So now the Replit agent builds Mastra agents. So you can vibe code your agent, right? And I think when we say that, it's not just that, that two-part statement that you made, it's not just that anyone can build AI applications and agents, but AI allows everybody to become a developer. I think I see that future the most when I'm in the Replit office and we see kind of what users are doing with their vibe coding agents, right? People are building these amazing kind of integrations or these sort of agents that integrate trigger off of real world, linear or Notion type things and have an agentic piece. And then, and they're not dragging and dropping a bunch of stuff and creating a big visual thing. It's they're vibe coding it the same way they vibe code their websites. So, right. I think we've gotten used to, We're moving into a world where we're not just going to have 10 million, developers. We're going to have 100 million developers. We might have a billion developers because the models are good enough to translate intent into reality. And I think it's just it's a tremendously, I think it's hard to, in some ways, to to, you know, like we're already just seeing so many people that used to be reliant on, you know, oh, I can't do this because I have I don't have a development resources to build this tool for like myself or at my, you know, in finance or in operations or in HR or like whatever else, right? It's incredibly exciting time to be alive and I think we're starting to get to where people are not just building apps, but people are building agents. And I would love to see a billion agents, you know, created with Mostra. Will that happen by 2030?
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, we do not have the crystal ball, but it sounds promising to me. Before we wrap up, where can people find Mostra, the book, or even connect with you on social platform or elsewhere?
I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn. My Twitter X handle is Calcsam, CalcSam. And you can also, you know, to your point, you can get a copy of the book. We give them out for free at mostra.ai/book if you want to get a copy for free. And you know, like we hand these out at events. Like it's just, you know, it's not just that we're an open source company, but we think that like it's just really important to us to help onboard folks into the world of agents and AI engineering.
Thanks for all the good work you're doing for the AI community to grow bigger. To get done with the closing segment, I would pass it over to Matt.
Thanks, Sam. So for you, Sam, thank you so much for joining us. These conversations about the future of agent frameworks and developer tooling has been an eye-opening for everyone. And for the one questions that we have, that if the developers that want to get started with Mostra today, what's the best first step?
Well, you can just go to your command line and npm create Mostra at latest. So, you know, or like go to mostra.ai and you know, go through some of the docs, but you can just go to your command line npm create Mostra at latest.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sam, once again. And for everyone listening, you can find show notes, links, transcripts at our website. If you've enjoyed this episode, subscribe to Inside Assemble AI, where you get your podcast. And if you're building with AI agents, we'd love to hear from you. Reach out to LinkedIn or X. Until next time, keep building. Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. This was super fun.
If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblogs.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code PODCAST at joyandblokes.com.